All right. So, kind of by way of review, slightly brief review, because again, like I said, we have a lot to cover tonight, so won't review a lot. Okay, of just kind of where we're at, right? We're about to enter into the book of Leviticus, okay? And so where we've kind of gone through this class, going through Genesis and Exodus so far, okay, as we've kind of gone through, laid the foundation in Genesis of the nation, right? And then if you remember in Exodus, we were putting like those values, those core values like faith, that God fights for Israel, that he is with them, like all those things like were established in Genesis. And then we saw in Exodus that kind of getting put on national display, right? Through the Lord's kind of showdown with Pharaoh, right? And the 10 plagues and all that happening, right? If you guys remember that, that we really started to see those values of Genesis put on national or international display, right? Because if you remember, as we saw all the way back in Genesis like 10 and 11, right, is God is raising up a nation to have an international impact, right? When you have a variety of nations in the world, you are going to need a nation who is a witness, a light to those other nations of the true God, right, to declare more of who he is. Okay, and we saw that unfolding in Exodus, right? And if you remember, as we left off a couple weeks ago, where you have the end of Exodus, where they build the tabernacle, God fills the tabernacle, right, with his glory so that no one can even stand before him. And the question we asked at the end of Exodus was, how can, right, a holy God dwell amongst sinful people, right? Because what we started to see in Exodus also is, it was Israel like kind of an upstanding nation and all that? No, they were sinful, right? They had their problems, right? As we're going to see, might not quite get there in numbers yet tonight, but we'll see even more so. They have a lot of problems, right? And so the question is, like, how can a holy God dwell amongst a sinful people without, like, killing them, essentially, right? Like, that's what he even told them, like, Moses originally. He's like, I can't go with you. I will kill all of you, right? Like, that's just not going to happen, right? And so then there's still that question of how do we do that? And that's where we come into the book of Leviticus, right? That's really what Leviticus is going to kind of answer and show. And God is going to establish further this system, right, within the Mosaic Covenant to allow for people to be able to dwell in the midst of a holy God, right? And so that's what we're going to see in Leviticus, okay? So that brings us up to here. All right, so kind of your introduction, as we've been doing all along. Title of the book, right? We get our Leviticus from, like, the Latin, which is based on, like, Greek, which I don't want to say that Greek word. It's all right. That really means, like, that which concerns the Levites or that which concerns the priests, right? That's really what the Greek word, as well as kind of what our Leviticus, you can hear in the name, like Levite, kind of in the name, that which concerns the priests or Levites, okay? And this is kind of fitting, right? Because as you read through Leviticus, you will see that that is kind of a major theme, is kind of how, like, certain things relate to the priests and all that. Like, they're heavily involved in this book, okay? But as we're going to see, like, there's more to it than that, right? This isn't just about the priests. This is about the people, about the nation, right? And how they are supposed to live as well, right? So it's not just about that, all right? And then the Hebrew title, all right, which again is drawn from, like, the opening word of the book, which is Vayikra, all right, which means, and he called, okay? Which you can kind of see there in verse 1 if you're in Leviticus, where it says, like, the Lord called Moses, right? It's just taken from that first word, and he called, okay? But again, kind of the importance of this, just like we saw with Exodus, is in the Hebrew, right, it starts with that and, right? Which means that, what? It's continuing the narrative, right? The story is continuing. It's very fitting. And just like we saw, like, at the end of Exodus, the glory of the Lord filling the tabernacle, right? Now you have, right here in Leviticus, the Lord calling out from the tabernacle, talking to Moses, right? So it's like just continuing the narrative, continuing the story. We're moving on, okay? And so it's continuing the narrative that we've seen all the way from Genesis up through now, right? It's just a continual narrative taking place, okay? Theme of the book, all right? Theme of the book really is, like, I'll describe it as the God who is holy and demands holiness, All right? The God who is holy and demands holiness. Okay? That is really going to be very clear throughout the book of Leviticus, this emphasis on holiness. All right? And it's ultimately rooted in the holiness of God, that he is a holy God and therefore demands holiness from his people. Right? You even have kind of the fitting verse that summarizes this in Leviticus 19:2, where he says, what? You shall be holy, for I, the Lord, am holy. Right? That really encapsulates the theme of this book, right? You shall be holy, for I, the Lord, your God, am holy. Okay? And so there's this reality. He is holy, and as such, demands holiness. Okay? And so again, this is going to show how can they be holy, right? How can Israel be holy and dwell amongst this holy God? And that's what we're going to see, all right? And then you have there the structure of the book, all right? Just a little outline there, dividing the various parts for that, all right? Should be there in your notes as well. All right, so let's get into the book of Leviticus, all right? And so probably for most people, right, Leviticus is not like your go-to, I'm about to have my devotions, I'm going to Leviticus, right? Like, and even if you try like reading the Bible in a year, sometimes you might get to Leviticus and you start to get a little burnt out, or you might even like, yeah, let's go to Numbers or Deuteronomy or something else, right? Like, as you kind of start working your way through. But what I hope to kind of show tonight is really like how applicable it really is and how crucial it is, not only for understanding and having a proper understanding and background of the Old Testament, right? But even some of the New Testament, right? Because we're going to see things, and I'll point out a couple items there that connect with the New Testament and really make you value like salvation, right? And like the work of Christ on our behalf, right? Because that's ultimately what all this is like pointing to, right? And looking forward to, okay? And so it is a very significant book. And so, but again, it starts out right away with laws concerning sacrifices, right? Which again, as maybe you're like, I'm going to do it, I'm going to read through, and then you get hit right away with seven chapters of like sacrifices, right? Maybe not the most exciting thing, all right? But they're important to kind of go through, okay? And so kind of some background before we jump into some of the specific sacrifices, right? We're going to be talking about five different ones. There are five main ones, okay? And when I think of sacrifices, like, and especially as when I was younger and different things, like, I really thought only sacrifices in the context of sacrifices for sin, right? Like, that somehow all these are related to sin and all that, and that's what these sacrifices are for. But what we're actually going to see is that only two of them are actually for sin. Okay? Like, only two of the five are actually geared towards sacrifices that are a result of sin. Okay? And the other three really just have to do with worship. Right? They really have to do with worship. Okay? And so what we start to see kind of at that foundational level already, right, is that life is more than just dealing with sin, right? Like, life is more than just dealing with sin. It's about worship, okay? And it involves dealing with sin, yes, but as we see here right away, it's more than just that, okay? That there is actually, you can do these sacrifices as acts of worship, okay? All right. And second, right, we have to remember that these sacrifices are part of the law. Okay, they are part of the law, part of the Mosaic Covenant, okay? And so, if you remember, like, the purpose of the Mosaic Covenant is to teach, right? It's to instruct. And so, in the same way as the law is to teach and to point us, like, to that which saves you, right? The law doesn't save you, but points to that which saves you. The sacrifices kind of do the same thing, right? They are a language themselves where they teach and they instruct, okay? That's kind of their purpose, okay? And what we'll see, right, is that none of these sacrifices, like, saved anyone, okay? Just like with the law, like, obeying the law, which these sacrifices would have been a part of, by doing these sacrifices, this isn't what saved you, okay? It did not save you. But rather, right, like, when it speaks of, like, atoning for sin and stuff like that, it really more so has to do with kind of your relationship with God within the covenant. Okay, and so in the system of the covenant, when you do the sacrifices and you follow that, like, you're okay with God, okay, in a sense, in the system. But these sacrifices never removed sin, right? That's why they had to keep sacrificing. And that's why, like, Hebrews can talk about and say the blood of bulls and animals and all that, like, never took away, like, could never take away sin, right? That's what we see, okay? And so these sacrifices are meant to teach. They're meant to point you to that which does save you, okay? And so it points to this reality of, like, sacrifices are crucial, right? You need a sacrifice to cover your sins. You need sacrifice to deal with that gap between you and God. But what you're eventually going to need is what? The ultimate sacrifice, right? Of Christ, as we know through Scripture, right? And so, again, you need to recognize that the sacrifices, the law, like, it doesn't save you, right? And it wasn't that Israel was saved through these sacrifices, okay? But it was all part of this system. And if an Israelite recognized, right, what this system was pointing to, teaching to, right, linking with, as we talked about before, Genesis 3:15, the promise of a seed who's going to one day rule and kind of bear our sin and all that, as we see later on, like in Isaiah, if someone of an Israelite believes that, right, that's how they have saving faith. That's how they're saved. Not through the sacrifices or the laws, right, but through faith, as we've always seen, okay? And that's how you can have people do these sacrifices and still be sinful and, like, far from God, right? Like, if you read the book of Isaiah, right, and, like, right away in the first chapter, the Lord's like, I'm tired of your sacrifices. Stop doing it, because you do these sacrifices, but then your hearts are, like, far from me. You still sin, all that, right? And so just doing the sacrifices doesn't necessarily equate to, oh, I'm saved, okay? Hopefully, if you are saved, you're going to be doing these sacrifices, right? Like, that kind of cause and effect type of thing. But the sacrifices don't save you, okay? And lastly, kind of the background with this is that they're not only supposed to teach and instruct Israel, but also the nations, right? And so when nations come, they see them sacrificing and doing these things. They can ask, why do you do this, right? Why do you have to go through all these different processes, different, like, they're all pretty intricate and all that. Why do you have to do that? And what? It's an opportunity for Israel to teach and explain. It's because our God is holy, right? And he demands this holiness. Right? This is why we do this. Okay? Opportunity to not only teach Israel, but also the nations. Okay? All right. So with that in mind, let's look at some of these offerings. All right? So the first one, burnt offering. Okay? Burnt offering. Kind of encompassing chapter 1 there. Okay? This is one of the offerings for worship, primarily for worship. Okay? Doesn't mention really sin in here. Okay? But really what this sacrifice has, right, because the process of this one is the whole animal was burnt on the altar, right? So you'd give the whole animal, it would all be consumed on the altar, okay? And kind of the emphasis of this offering is to denote total consecration to the Lord, okay? Total consecration to the Lord, which is why the whole animal is burnt, okay? The worshiper is stating that they are wholly devoted to the Lord. That's kind of the purpose of this, okay? And it mentions, like in verse 4, making atonement for him, but the idea of atonement there seems to not be as much a covering of sin as much as this, like, being 100% set apart for God, okay? That's really what this is. There's no mention of sin in this passage, as we see in, like, the other ones that we're going to look at a little bit later, okay? And so this worshiper is consecrating himself fully to the Lord. That's the point of the burnt offering, okay? So you can start to see why that's like an act of worship, not necessarily for sin, okay? Second, grain offering, okay? Another sacrifice of worship, and the main kind of purpose of this is as thanksgiving for the Lord's provision, all right? Thanksgiving for the Lord's provision, okay? It often involved thanking the Lord for like the first fruits of your crop. All right, the first fruits being that initial part of your crop that grows, and it's normally the indication that the rest is going to follow, okay? But you would give and offer some of those first fruits to the Lord, okay, in giving thanks for his provision, okay? Expressing thankfulness to the Lord for what he has provided, okay? And so in this case, some of the portion would be given to the priest as well, right? Some of it's burned, offered to the Lord, some is given to the priest as well, okay? Third one, peace offerings, all right? Peace offerings, or some might say like fellowship offering, okay? Either one, kind of the same idea. These offerings are also an act of worship. They could be offered for giving thanks as part of a vow, or even just wanting to worship the Lord, you can offer this offering, okay? And in this case, right, the fat of the animal would be, like, removed, okay? And then the fat would be burned on the altar, all right? And you might be wondering, that's weird. That seems kind of weird to just take the fat and all that. But back then, especially, right, like, the fat was, like, the choicest part of the animal, right, the meal, okay? And so what you're essentially doing by removing all the fat, giving it to the Lord, is saying what? The Lord gets the best part, right? The Lord gets the best of it, okay? You're giving to the best of the Lord, okay? And then with the remaining meat, all right, we see that the what tends to happen, right, is that some of the meat would be given to the priest and some to the worshiper, and they would actually eat like the meat like that day. Okay, they would kind of have like a fellowship kind of meal with this, okay? And so, and that's why it's called like a fellowship offering sometimes, right? It's because this aspect of the priest and the worshiper eating together, okay? And really, what this sacrifice is celebrating then is what? Your relationship with God as well as one another, right? Celebrating your relationship with God as well as with one another, okay? That's what's going on in the peace offering or the fellowship offerings. All right. And that's the last of our kind of worship sacrifices, okay? So these last two, right, the sin offerings and the guilt offerings, they are the two that are geared towards dealing with sin, right? Which kind of makes sense. You have sin offering, all right? Kind of hits the nail on the head there, okay? And so what we need to point out real quick, if you're in chapter 4 of Leviticus, looking there at the sin offerings. Notice in verse 2 what the Lord says in regard to what sins these are dealing with, right? It says unintentional sins, okay? And what you'll see if you read through like the sin offering and the guilt offering is that there's this continual repetition on unintentional sins and sins where people sin and then they later find out their guilt. And then they're called to, like, kind of deal with it, okay? And so what we have here, if you look through this, is there is actually no sacrifice within these main five that actually has anything to do with intentional sins, okay? Which, if I'm sure in your life you can imagine, you sin intentionally pretty often, right? Like, it happens, okay? And so kind of the question is, like, what are you supposed to do, right? What are you supposed to do with that? Because there's no sacrifice there, right, of these five. And so that question is, what do you do with intentional sins? And so kind of we'll deal with this a little bit later, right? Because there is a solution, kind of like a catch-all, okay, that we're going to see a little bit later. But again, you start to also see the limitations of this system, right? You see the limitations of it, okay? That, like, what we see eventually, why Christ is like greater in all these things is what? Because even his sacrifice covers intentional sins, right? And all that. But we'll come back to this a little bit later, okay? As we get a little bit further in Leviticus, there's an event that we'll talk about that deals with these intentional sins. But for right now, these offerings are for unintentional sins, okay? That's what you need to understand, okay? So if you read through these, depending upon kind of who you are, your status in society, all that, right? Like you offer different animals, okay? It could be a bull or goat, or even like, I think, like a lamb and all that, right? Like different things, depending on kind of who you are and all that, okay? And so what you would do, okay? As you bring this animal, you would lay your hands on the animal, right? Maybe you're familiar with that concept. And in so doing, right, you were showing that you are linked with this animal, okay? You are linked with this animal, okay? It's not necessarily that the animal is, like, taking your sins, okay? As we've talked about, they don't necessarily take your sin, okay? But you're linking yourself with this animal, and the animal is slaughtered because what? You should die for this sin, right? You're understanding that I deserve death, and this animal is dying in my place because of that, okay? Which, again, starts kind of this theology of sacrifice that you see built throughout Scripture, again, culminating Christ, like why we need a sacrifice on our behalf, okay? That he bears, actually, the sin and everything. And it's interesting, right? If you read through kind of the different structure of the sin offering and what they do there, is that as part of the sin offering, there's kind of elements of the burnt offering and the peace offering kind of combined into this sin offering, okay? There's elements of both. For example, like the fat is burned on all the offerings, like in the peace offering, okay? The fat's removed, burned, just like the peace offering, okay? And then in some of the sacrifices, you have kind of the rest of the animal taken outside the camp, like, and burned wholly, okay? Like the burnt offering type of thing, okay? And so some people argue that this is actually what is going on, that the peace offering and the burnt offering are part of the sin offering for a purpose, right? To show that what? Like, when you complete this offering, like, you are now dedicated to the Lord, okay? You're being dedicated to the Lord again, which is what? The burnt offering side of it, okay? But then more than that, since you now have that relationship, you can have peace with God as well. Okay, which is the peace offering, okay, side of it. And so it seems that in the sin offering, what you're doing is that kind of aspect, right? You're dealing with your sin to the point now you are dedicated again to the Lord, consecrated to him, and now you are at peace with him once again. Okay, does that make sense? Kind of that combo of that. Okay, and that's kind of what's going on. Okay, and so then in the sin offering, not only is your sin dealt with, like in the system kind of a thing, right? But you're also consecrated to the Lord and at peace with him. And so then some people also point to the similarity that this has with, like, the work of Christ later on, right? Where, like, say, like in Romans, when Romans 5:1, where it talks about since now we have been justified, right? That we have been kind of set apart and declared righteous, okay? That now we have peace with God as well. Right? There's this element that it sounds very similar to this idea of the sin offering, okay? So that's our sin offering. Last one, guilt offering, okay? Guilt offering. You see this laid out, okay? And again, these are still for unintentional sins, okay? Text is clear on that. And the main difference between the guilt and the sin offering, okay, is kind of the issue of restitution, right? The issue of restitution, right? The guilt offering involves dealing with the consequences of your sin, okay? That if, like, your sin in some way defrauded someone or did something, like, you are to kind of act to provide restitution for that, right? You are supposed to kind of make things right, in a sense, in addition to your sacrifice. So you still offer a sacrifice, but then it's also kind of making amends with that person, okay? So that's what the difference between the two is. And again, on a little side note with that, like, what's interesting, if you zoom ahead further in the Old Testament, right, where you have Isaiah 53 with the suffering servant, if you guys remember that passage, where one of the clearest passages about kind of the suffering of the Messiah, that he's going to die for his people, bear their sins. If you're looking in that passage, right, in verse 10, it talks about how he will make a guilt offering for his people, right? Or some say, like, an offering for guilt for us. And so kind of the purpose there, right, is to show that Christ's sacrifice not only deals with our sin, but also, like, the collateral damage of our sin, the consequences of it. He deals with all of it, right? His sacrifice will cover every aspect of it, okay? Which is really cool, all right? And again, we see that through understanding more of what the guilt offering is all about. Okay? We good? Any questions on the offerings there? Awesome. All right. Last little section here of this first section of the laws concerning sacrifices is sacrifices and the priests, okay, where we see some instructions more geared towards the priests, okay? And kind of it turns the attention to the role of the priest in these sacrifices, okay? Because the priests also need to understand their job, right? There's two sides of this process of the sacrifices, the responsibility of the worshiper as well as the responsibility of the priest, okay? And so it goes into further details about all those five sacrifices, okay? And so really what this shows is how holy this whole process is, right? The way you become holy needs to be holy, okay? And that includes both sides, on the priest side as well as the worshiper side. All of it needs to be holy, okay? That's what's going on here. All right. And then our next section, consecration of the priests, okay? So chapter 8, we see Aaron and his sons consecrated. They are ordained as priests. They go through this whole process that ends up taking like a week, 7 days, okay, as they do a couple sacrifices to purify, cleanse them, prepare them to serve as priests before the Lord, okay? And again, this is emphasizing the holiness of the Lord, right? Because those who are supposed to intercede between God and man need to be holy, right? They need to be cleansed. They need to be pure as well, okay? And so Aaron and his sons are fully consecrated to the Lord, right? That's what's happening, okay? And it takes 7 days. And then at the end of those 7 days, in chapter 9, we see that they offer some sacrifices, right? They offer essentially all the sacrifices except the guilt offering, right? Some people kind of suggest it's almost like a trial run. Hopefully you don't mess up, right? It's like, this is your moment, okay? And so they perform all these offerings, okay? Sin offerings, burnt offerings, grain offerings, peace offerings, all that kind of involved there, okay? And then what we see, right, as they perform all these, if you look at the end of the chapter in verse 24, it says, "And fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the pieces of fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces." All right. And so essentially what? The Lord accepts this offering, right? Like fire comes out from before the Lord, which I'm sure would have been terrifying, which is why everyone screams and falls on their faces, right? Again, seeing the holiness of God on display. But we see that he accepts the sacrifice, okay? Consuming it. And keep that kind of wording in mind as we come to this next section, all right? Because right away, we have now this section in chapter 10, when everything seems to be going well and good and all that, the story of Nadab and Abihu, okay, which some of you might remember this, okay? Nadab and Abihu, they're sons of Aaron, okay? They're priests of Israel. They were just part of this whole consecration thing that was happening in the previous chapters. They were just ordained as these priests. But then notice what they do, okay? These two guys, they each took a censer, put fire in it and laid incense on it and offered, the text says, unauthorized fire, or some say strange fire, before the Lord, okay, which he had not commanded. We don't know what exactly they did, okay, but the emphasis here is what? Like it says in verse 1, this is something that God had not commanded, right? It was something different, okay? And so you have to understand, if it's not exactly how God wants it, if it's not exactly God's way, it's not holy. It's strange. It's unauthorized, right? That's the point of this, right? Is to emphasize that, that God is sovereign over this whole process of how you become holy. What is holiness? God determines that, not us, okay? And so notice what happens, right? They offer this strange fire, this unauthorized fire. And notice in verse 2, it says, "Fire came out from before the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord." Okay? And notice the language there, right? "And fire came out from before the Lord and consumed them." Where did we just hear that language? Yeah, just in verse 24 of chapter 9, right? Where like the Lord accepts the offering. And so what do you kind of have here by using that same imagery is what? They became the sacrifice, right? They became the sacrifice, essentially, is what happened. Where if you don't offer the right sacrifice, you become the sacrifice, right? That's kind of what happens, okay? And the point here is seen in verse 3, right? It says, Moses says to Aaron, this is what the Lord has said, among those who are near me, I will be sanctified, which another word for that is I will be holy, okay? I will be sanctified, and before all the people, I will be glorified. That's his point. That's the point there, right? Is I am holy, and I'm going to be sanctified by the people who are near me, okay? And so, and lastly, like, and we see Aaron's response, right? Is what? And Aaron held his peace, right? Both of it, like, two of his sons just died, were consumed, right? But he holds his peace. Why? Because he recognizes God's right, right? Like, there's no objection to that. Like, they disobeyed, they offered this unauthorized, this strange fire. God is right, okay? And so this is really a reminder that the nature of God's holiness is, it's sovereign, right? Like, we don't get a choice to determine, like, what we think holiness should look like. God is the one who determines what holiness should look like, right? Like, and there's no arguing, there's no deviating from that. And that's why, like, some people can think, like, well, why can't I just get to God on my own terms? Why can't I get to God the way I want to? And it's what? Because you become, the way you become holy must be holy. Okay, and there's only one way that satisfies God's holiness and his justice, and that's his way. That's why. Okay, that even in his holiness, he is sovereign over all of it. Okay? So very sobering reminder with that. All right, and then in chapters 11 through 15, we really start to deal with this idea of clean versus unclean. Okay, clean versus unclean. And so what we really see is that God demands holiness in every aspect of life, right? Like even in stuff like something as mundane as the food you eat, right? Even in the high points of your life, like childbirth or even in personal like health issues, right? Like there is a demand for holiness in all of it. Okay. We are called and they are called to be holy in all of it. Okay. Whatever the case, God demands holiness from his people. And so as you read through this section, right, like, you have to understand this idea of clean versus unclean is not the same thing as saying, like, right versus wrong, okay? Like, unclean does not mean, like, you're sinful, necessarily, okay? Could be, but not necessarily, right? But rather, what this idea, right, has to do with, like, your closeness to God. That's, like, the clean versus unclean. Okay, and some people use the example of, like, say with, like, a loved one, like, if they don't shower for a while, they are unclean, right? And you might not want to run up and hug them right away if they smell real bad, right? Or something like that, okay? But, like, so in the same way, right, like, in a similar way, for the Israelites, when they are clean or unclean, it affects what? Their relationship and their proximity to the Lord, right? Because if you're unclean, you can't do certain things. You can't go into, like, the courts of the tabernacle. You can't do some of those things if you're unclean, right? But as you see through these various things, being unclean isn't necessarily, again, a sin, right? It can be from various situations that arise, right? Like if you get sick, it's not like you sinned, right? Like it's, you're now unclean, yes, and you need to deal with that, go through the process, but it doesn't mean you are sinful, okay? But again, kind of with all of this, it's all meant to communicate the holiness that God demands. And it communicates, especially, right? Like if you read through, like, for example, like the different animals they're supposed to eat and not eat and different things, right? That would speak volumes to the nations, right? Like that, like we don't eat these certain animals. Why? Because our God is holy. That there are certain animals that are more associated with death, like scavengers, right? And different things. There's animals that are more like disgusting, right? And different things are gross. And so we don't associate with that. Like our God doesn't associate with that. Okay. And it puts on display to the nations around them, right? Like that their God is holy, that their God is different. Okay. And so really it's putting on display the glory and holiness of God. That's what this is all the purpose of. Okay? All right. Chapter 16, Day of Atonement. Let's see, I got 750. We'll take a couple-minute break real quick, and then we'll come back. We'll do a little bit shorter break so we can get through more, but then we'll come back, all right?